This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Return of the King, written by Brian Winhurst and Dave McMenamin. Read by Brian Winhurst and Dave McMenamin. To the NBA family and the league's fans, whose professionalism, support, and passion have enabled a dream job to come true, BW. To Mom, Dad, Melanie, Shauna, Brian, Jeff, Rob, Ollie, Connell, Magooch, and Dr. James Naismith, thanks for all your support as I continue to follow the bouncing ball around the world. I love you. DM.
Introduction, as told by Richard Jefferson. This is a story that not many people know. Sure, they know how the Cavaliers became the first team in 52 years to bring a major championship back home to Cleveland. They know how the Cavs became the first team to overcome a 3-1 deficit in the NBA Finals to come back and win. They know how we beat the first team ever to win 73 games during the regular season to do so. They know we became the first team since the Washington Bullets in 1978 to win a Game 7 of the Finals on the road and hoist the Larry O'Brien Trophy on the same floor that our opponents fought so hard to host the game on. But they don't know what happened to the Larry O'Brien Trophy 3 days later, when more than a million people descended upon downtown Cleveland for a championship parade the likes of which has never been seen before. The story starts with me and Channing Frye. We were supposed to be in our own individual cars to soak it all in during the parade route. Somehow, Channing ended up on a flatbed truck with his family. We both have little kids. I was like, yo, I'd rather jump in here with you guys than be stuck in a convertible, because it was hot out. So me and my family, we jump in that car with the Fries and we're just taking in the scene, and it was mayhem. People everywhere, lined up 15, 20 deep wherever you looked. On rooftops, climbing out of windows, hanging on street lamps, everywhere. I realized the magnitude of what this day was. You could tell that the city had never planned a championship parade in, well, 50 years. They didn't know that they needed to have guardrails up. They didn't know what hit them. Kind of like the Warriors, actually. I remember about halfway through the parade, me and Channing look over, and I see this guy running next to the car with a big towel covering up something in his arms. I was like, that looks like the trophy. And the guy, he's running. And he's not running fast because our cars aren't really moving. And he says to us, hey, do you guys want this? And I'm like, yeah, we'll take it. In my head, I'm thinking, oh, this is our turn. He's just taking the trophy from car to car and everyone gets some time with the trophy. So he gets on the truck with us and after a few minutes, after we've been raising the trophy and after the crowd is going crazy every time we lift it up and the sun shimmers off its polished sphered head, the guy was like, you don't understand how happy I was to see you guys. I mean, everyone was happy to see us that day. We just won a championship for Cleveland, but there was a different level of appreciation coming from this guy. I was like, what are you talking about? Didn't you just bring this over from another player? You've seen one Cavs player lift this thing up. You've seen them all, right? He was like, Richard, the trophy was on the back of a truck that went the wrong way at the start of the parade route. So all of a sudden, it's me, the trophy, 1 million fans, and no security, no nothing. Oh. He was panicked. He unbolted the thing and started running around looking for a place to put it. He said, your car was the first one that we happened to see, and we latched on like Rose to the floating door in Titanic. So that's the story of how it came to be that the only people with video or pictures with the trophy during the parade are me and Channing, two lifelong friends ever since I helped recruit him to our alma mater, the University of Arizona, because some guy ended up stumbling upon our truck in the parade route. He didn't bother bringing it to anybody else, you know, like that LeBron James guy. It kind of felt like all the things that had to happen for us to become champions. I know the city of Cleveland can relate. While Northeast Ohioans lived through the shot, the fumble, the drive, and the decision, I had my own downfalls on the biggest stage before I finally had my championship moment. In the days leading up to Game 7, in my head I ran through all of them. I've come up just short so many times. I lost back-to-back finals with the then New Jersey Nets. I've been top 10 in the league in scoring multiple years and didn't make an All-Star game. I've been on the U.S. Olympic team, but it was the team with Larry Brown and a bunch of misfits, and we had to fight just to win the bronze. So it was just like always so close. This was my entire life. This was my entire career. I'm not Tristan Thompson, who is 25 years old. I'm not Kyrie Irving, who has his whole career in front of him. This could be it for me. When I was a kid, I'd imagine what I'd do if I was fortunate enough to win it all. Somehow it worked out just the way I pictured it. As soon as the buzzer sounded, everyone takes off, jumping and hugging and piling up on top of one another, and I was the one guy on the bench that just kind of froze there and just put my head in my hands and started crying. I wouldn't say I was sobbing. I wouldn't say I was weeping. It was just more of, wow, man. Not only have I been through so much in 15 years in the league, but to feel it for those 10 days just slipping through our hands again after falling down 3-1 and to come this close, it was something. After the amount of stress that was in all that, the championship feeling was a feeling of relief. The initial feeling wasn't that of joy for me. It was of relief. But as the night unfolded, that scene was everything I wanted it to be. Everything I dreamed it would be. Everything I imagined it ever would be. It was all those things. And so what did I do? My big mouth started telling anyone who would listen in the locker room as my feet splashed through puddles of champagne that I was retiring. When I initially said it, I really was done. I was so emotionally spent. It was a wrap for me. Like, you're talking about not sleeping for 10 days. I took Tylenol PM at 6 a.m. one time to try to get some sleep. You're going East Coast to West Coast, and you're running on fumes at that point in time. 3 days later, I was at the rally downtown after the parade, standing in front of hundreds of thousands of people and shouting into a microphone that I was coming back. What changed? I wouldn't say things calmed down, but you start to enjoy it. You start to think. Was I all the way out when I said I was retiring? No. But at the same time, I was thinking, I don't know if I can go through this again. Even being on the winning side of it. Even being on the winning side of it, I don't know if I could go through it again just because it was that stressful. And finally, at the end, I just thought about it. And it was more about my family. They are enjoying it. My body? It felt great, even in my mid-30s after playing in 100-something games. And then the championship experience. It doesn't end at the parade. Part of winning a championship is being there on opening night when they raise the banner. Part of winning a championship is getting your ring from Adam Silver before that first game. Part of winning a championship is going into every city and just feeling that respect and also trying to defend your crown. One of the reasons I always wanted to be a champion was so I could defend it. That was half of it. So the more I started thinking about it, the more I was just like, okay, I don't want to miss out on that experience. Because this is once in a lifetime, and this team is once in a lifetime. There's no way you could come back the way we did, from 3-1 down, unless you are tight, unless you are brothers. It doesn't mean you have to be best friends. It doesn't mean that all 15 of you guys are out together at every dinner. We're all different personalities. Nobody could match my personality anyway. Come on, let's be real. The thing is, you have to be able to look each man in the eye and say, hey, I'm going to do my job. If you do your job, we're good. If you're struggling, I'll lift you up. And all year long, there was always speculation about this dynamic and that dynamic and what this meant and what that meant. It was just like people would see LeBron and Kyrie or LeBron and Kevin get frustrated at each other, but they wouldn't see them at dinner the very next night cracking jokes. We did get closer as the season went along. We did love taking part in social media and putting stuff on Snapchat for the fans to see how we really are. That did make us closer. I think for a while people saw us and thought, how am I going to root for guys that hate each other? They would rather believe that guys are awesome and hang out because they want to believe that. And I think once we kind of showed that to the fans and allowed them to see for themselves that, yo, LeBron, as much as he's special on the court, he's a big goofball. And man, Kev doesn't take himself too seriously. That's cool. It was just like everybody was going to have fun with this ride. and it didn't matter if we won 10 straight to start the playoffs. If we had lost 2 in a row in the conference finals, if we were down 0-2 in the finals, if we were down 3-1 and on the brink of elimination, we stayed pretty consistent throughout the whole thing. And so did Cleveland. They got behind us like no fan base has ever gotten behind a team I've played for before. It was like, even if you weren't a basketball fan, if you weren't from Cleveland, the fact that you knew that the so-called story of the town was that there hadn't been a championship in 50 years, you were rooting. For my son, Little Richard, there's now a connection to him in Cleveland. Little Rich learned how to walk in Cleveland. These guys, my brothers on the Cavs, they've watched him go from being carried to taking his first steps to running around, and now all of a sudden, he's in the locker room and he loves basketball. I'd like to think that we gave him a pretty good first taste of what the game is supposed to look like at its best. Say what you want about LeBron, but not many people in a team sport can say, hey, I'm going to come back to my hometown, to a city that's never won a championship in half a century, and a team that's never experienced a championship run, period, and I'm going to go, and we're going to win one. Actually, forget I said not many people say that. No one says that. No one in the history of a team sport has ever said that. This is all LeBron has ever known. This is all he's ever known. Basketball and being the best. That's all he's ever known since he was probably about 15 years old. That will mess with your psyche a little bit. You can lose touch. Hell, maybe you need to have a messed up psyche to do what he did and leave Miami to come back to the Cavs. But I will say this about LeBron. At his core, all he wants to do is win. And he does it by wanting to be a good teammate and by wanting everyone to be successful. That's just who he is. Oh, one more thing. My wife is pregnant again. A daughter is going to be born in Cleveland, which I think is awesome. She'll come into this world in the City of Champions.
Chapter 1. All Not for Z. The lights were shut off, and for a moment, the crowd of 20,000 roared with the sudden excitement of anticipation. Just as quickly, they fell silent. A million-dollar 3D video projection system, leased and installed in the ceiling for this moment, lit the arena with a mixture of visual tricks that made it seem like the hardwood floor was as liquid as water, followed by an incredible display of video highlights, graphics, colors, and audio clips that took programmers weeks to design. Watching from the darkness at the edge of the room were dozens of men in suits, all flown in at great expense by the Cleveland Cavaliers franchise, to be tangential parts of the most elaborate jersey retirement ceremony the NBA had ever seen. Not even Michael Jordan had gotten the sort of treatment Zydrunas Ilgauskas was getting on this night. It was March 8th, 2014, a carefully selected date that was months in the planning and years in the plotting. After speeches and congratulations from numerous former teammates, coaches, team executives, trainers, and friends, and after his father, who'd come from Lithuania, symbolically kissed the center court logo, Ilgauskas' two sons punched a button that sent his number 11 jersey to the rafters as smoke machines billowed to make it more dramatic. Fans recorded it with their cell phones, many wearing giveaway t-shirts in the team's wine and gold color scheme that read, hashtag, all for Z. This was charming, but it also wasn't totally true. It wasn't all for Z, Ilgauskas' nickname. A lot of it was for someone else, one of the men in the sea of suits. This was also for LeBron James. The Cavs' thinly veiled strategy to recruit James back 4 years after his departure clicked into public action with this expensive investment. Retire Ilgauskas' number, yes, but also show James he could come home again and he would be loved again, just like his peer. In 2010, just 3 days after James announced he was signing with the Miami Heat on a national television broadcast, and while Cavs fans and owner Dan Gilbert were still in a hot rage, Ilgauskas announced his intention to follow James to Miami as a free agent. After 12 years as a Cav, making two All-Star teams and setting a slate of franchise records, this move was seen as adding insult to injury. Ilgauskas soon got in on the blowback James had gotten for his choice. There was plenty of vitriol from the Cleveland area to go around. James's departure, announced on an hour-long television show on ESPN, The Decision, had deeply scarred the region. It was devastating to the team, but James was also a local leaving for the glamour of Miami. That hit a lot of people where they lived. In an economic downturn that had lasted for decades, many children of Northeast Ohio had left home looking for success outside the Rust Belt. Ohio is home to numerous well-respected universities, both large state institutions and small liberal arts colleges. For years, it had raised and educated young stars, only to see them take their talents elsewhere because of limited opportunities at home. It was a compound problem. Now James, one of the state's most treasured citizens, was doing it too. Targeting James for the way he announced his decision was a convenient excuse for amplifying the symbols of hatred. Many would have hated James for leaving no matter how he'd done it. Ilgauskas was proof of that. After deciding to leave, Ilgauskas bought a full-page ad in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, thanking the fan base for taking him in when he arrived from Lithuania and supporting him so it would become his home. If it dimmed any of the negativity, it was hard for him to notice. It was hurtful to Ilgauskas, who had actually been traded away from the Cavs the previous season, only to get a buyout from his new team, the Washington Wizards, before ever playing a game so he could immediately re-sign in Cleveland. Having already been traded and after losing his starting job when the Cavs acquired Shaquille O'Neal the previous year, Ilgauskas felt he'd been given a pretty good indication the team was moving on from him as a core player. Perhaps the worst was when it started to affect his wife, Jennifer, who owns successful healthcare-related businesses in the Cleveland area. Her business started suffering when standard referrals began drying up, which Ilgauskas believed was a kind of retribution. He was also booed mercilessly when he returned with the Heat. But after his retirement in 2011, Ilgauskas proved how he felt about the city when he moved back. He later went to work for the team's front office. This was a minor miracle, because Ilgauskas was also offended by an infamous letter to fans Gilbert released the night James announced he was leaving, calling James's move a shocking act of disloyalty and a cowardly betrayal. Ilgauskas felt like some of those accusations now essentially included him as well. Ilgauskas and Gilbert had never been very close. In 2005, 4 months after Gilbert bought the Cavs for $375 million, Ilgauskas thought he'd have to find a new home. He was a free agent, and he got the impression Gilbert wasn't interested in retaining him. In early July of that year, he was about to leave on a planned trip to Asia, figuring he might be on another team by the time he got back. Danny Ferry, a former Ilgauskas teammate who'd just been hired to be the team's general manager, convinced Gilbert to re-sign Ilgauskas. Ferry was concerned about the owner-player relationship, so he asked Gilbert to close the deal personally. This led to a fascinating little chase, as Gilbert and newly hired coach Mike Brown left the Cavs Summer League team in Las Vegas on Gilbert's plane to fly to Los Angeles to catch Ilgauskas during a layover before he left for Hong Kong. When they landed at LAX's private terminal, Gilbert ran into Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks and later the owner of the Seattle Supersonics. Gilbert blanched, knowing the Sonics were a team rumored to be interested in Ilgauskas as well. He wondered if he was being beaten to the punch. Out of a movie script, Gilbert ordered his driver to follow Schultz's car to see where he might be headed. But Schultz got on the freeway. Gilbert and Brown breathed a sigh of relief and went to the international terminal, where they bought tickets on Ilgauskas' flight so they could get through security. Nervous they had nothing to present, they bought cheap flowers and balloons at an airport gift shop to bring to the meeting. When it was over, Ilgauskas had agreed to a 5-year, $50 million deal. That ended up being the high point of the relationship, especially after Gilbert's behavior when Ilgauskas and James left. Yet not only was Ilgauskas back working for the team, here he was being adored by fans at a ceremony. That was the understated but serious message to James. The two had commiserated in Miami about how they'd been treated for their business decisions. They'd cursed Gilbert and the short-sightedness of fans who once claimed to love them. They'd basked in the winter sun and wondered how they'd lived through so many snowstorms. But Ogauskas was back in the cold north and happy to be raising his family there. And here he was being honored, the fans already having forgotten his foray to Miami. That is what those in the Cavs organization wanted James to see personally, that when it really mattered, Cleveland had the ability to move past what happened in 2010. It was to show that James, too, could come back and be happy raising his family at home and be embraced again by his home fans. The display was funded by Gilbert, but it was the brainchild of Chris Grant, the Cavs general manager, who had replaced Ferry in 2010. During James's second season in Miami, he took the surprising step of indicating publicly that he could see himself returning to play in Cleveland sometime in the future. In what would turn out to be a crucial moment, he opened the door and extended an olive branch on a snowy day in February 2012. "I think it would be great. It would be fun to play in front of these fans again. I had a lot of fun times in my 7 years here. You can't predict the future, and hopefully I continue to stay healthy. I'm here as a Miami Heat player, and I'm happy where I am now. But don't rule out returning in no sense. And if I decide to come back, hopefully the fans will accept me." James said this after a Heat practice inside Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland on an off day. Within seconds, the words had reached Grant's ears 10 miles away at the team's training facility. The concept of a James return had been whispered about, especially after he admitted he struggled with the transition to Miami. But here he was saying it, that he'd consider coming back. Though some dismissed it as James attempting to reduce the vitriol in Northeast Ohio, where he still lived in the off-season, some took it quite seriously, especially Grant, who was perhaps the first, and for a while the only, Cavs employee who truly believed the franchise could get him back. The following summer, a content James went even further. After winning his first championship in 5 games, over the Oklahoma City Thunder, and shedding the burden of never having won a ring, he was in London and on the verge of winning a second gold medal with the Olympic team. It was the most triumphant few months of his career. Getting wistful in an interview with the Associated Press, he again referred to missing Cleveland. "I wish I could have won one there. I could only imagine how the parade would have been down East 9th Street. Of course, I thought about it because Cleveland helped me get to that point. The days I spent there helped me get to the point where I was able to finally win one. It's just unfortunate I wasn't able to do it there." This was seen as salt in the wounds to some in Cleveland, which lamented seeing James win elsewhere. And Cleveland indeed saw it. Ratings reports from the 2012 finals showed the strongest local ratings outside of the South Florida and Oklahoma City markets were in Cleveland. But others, including those daring to dream inside the Cavs' offices, saw it as another gesture. Gilbert responded with his own coded message. The next time James visited Cleveland for a game in the 2012-13 season, Gilbert put out a message to fans on his social media. "Cleveland Cavaliers' young talent makes our future very bright. Clearly, LeBron's is as well. Time for everyone to focus on the road ahead." Even with all the time that had passed, the polite tone from the man who essentially championed an anti-James movement was revealing. Gilbert had been fined $100,000 by NBA Commissioner David Stern for sending out the letter in 2010. But had said in subsequent interviews that he had no regrets. After James left, Gilbert hired Jones Day, one of the largest law firms in the nation, to investigate whether the Heat had been engaged in long-term recruiting of James, which would have been a violation of NBA rules. In 1995, the Heat essentially admitted they were guilty of this sort of tampering when negotiating to bring Pat Riley in to run the franchise while he was coaching the New York Knicks. The Heat ultimately agreed to send the Knicks $1 million and a first-round draft pick to settle the matter, which might have been the best deal Miami owner Mickey Arison had ever made, considering Riley's positive influence on the franchise. Gilbert eventually decided not to file formal charges against the Heat. The burden of proof for such things is quite high, and the gray area teams operate in is quite wide. Grant was also against it, wanting to move on and not extend the issue. It wasn't bringing James back at that point anyway. Plus, the Cavs had held firm in working on a sign-and-trade deal with the Heat for James, getting 2 first-round picks and 2 second-round picks as a return for helping the Heat construct their super team that included Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. Not only was that a haul greater than the Cavs probably would have gotten had they been able to prove a tampering charge, but the Cavs agreeing to trade James to Miami undercut any potential argument. Gilbert had continued to stew, though, and in meetings he refused for several years to say James's name. So his sending out a message encouraging the fans to move on from the James hate was relevant. It also worked. For the first time that night, some fans at the arena applauded when James was introduced. It was far from the majority, but it sure was a departure from previous visits. During the game, a young fan named James Blair wandered onto the court in the middle of the game and approached James. He wore a t-shirt that read, "We miss you" on the front, and "Come back 2014 on the back. The 2014 reference was the first year James could be a free agent, more than a year away. Security swarmed Blair, but before they could take him off the floor, James disarmed the situation and went over to embrace him. It was a symbolic moment. There was a thaw happening on both sides. Blair was banned by the Cavs from attending future games, but the moment quickly became famous. The Heat, who can be masters at public relations, soon invited Blair to a game in Miami and gave him Heat gear in an effort to swing the situation. But it only revealed that the Heat had started paying attention to the James Cleveland developments. The following summer, James made another significant move when he left his agent at Creative Artists Agency, Leon Rose, and hired his longtime friend Rich Paul as his basketball agent. CAA had played a significant role in helping James go to Miami 2 years earlier, as it also represented Wade and Bosh and negotiated all of their contracts in concert. From its inception as a Hollywood talent agency, CAA had always been about packaging clients on films and shows to maximize commissions. This is what they did with their 3 biggest basketball clients, wrapping them up in a bundle. Business was business, but this had left some level of animosity between the Cavs and CAA. Paul worked for CAA at the time as a junior agent, but he'd managed to stay on good terms with the Cavs. The first game the Cavs played in the post-James era, a home game in October 2010 against Boston, Paul attended in his role as CAA agent. He lived in Cleveland and represented one of the Cavs' 2011 first-round draft picks, Tristan Thompson, which meant he was around the team frequently. It was Paul who called the team to inform them that James would be going to Miami, a move that was professional. Grant believed Paul operated in good faith and felt he could work with him. When Paul established his new agency, Clutch Sports, he partnered with Mark Termini, an experienced Cleveland-based attorney and agent who dealt with the Cavs dating to the 1980s when he represented star Ron Harper. As it would turn out, James's new representatives had both a history and respect from the team. So as James headed into the final year of his Heat contract at the start of the 2013-14 season, Grant started to put plans into action. The Heat had now won back-to-back titles, and James had won 2 Most Valuable Player awards and 2 Finals MVP awards. He looked not only to be thriving in Miami, but entrenched there. The concept of his leaving seemed far-fetched. But Grant wasn't deterred, especially once the Heat released Mike Miller, who was one of James's closest friends, to reduce luxury tax payments the following season. When James signed in Miami, CAA worked with Heat president Pat Riley to reduce the star's salaries from the max level down to make room on the payroll for a couple of role players. One was Udonis Haslam, a CAA client, and the other was Miller. Ultimately, James, Wade, and Bosh were in agreement to take less money, but James was not deeply involved in the process. The Heat were eventually able to work complex sign-and-trade deals to make all the math work. As time passed, the way it unfolded ended up upsetting James and contributed to his decision to leave CAA. Shortly after doing so, he signed with William Morris Endeavor, CAA's Hollywood enemy, to represent him in film and television work. So he was also displeased when the Heat released Miller, a move that saved the team $17 million in luxury taxes, because he was still receiving a smaller paycheck to pay Miller's salary. The Heat's roster was aging. They traded so many draft picks to acquire James and Bosch that they'd been unable to bring in many young players, and their heavy spending had made their luxury tax bill start to pile up and challenge their ability to keep the team together. Grant had a multifaceted plan. He wanted to sign a few veteran players to add to what was a promising young core, namely former Rookie of the Year Kyrie Irving, to help the Cavs make the playoffs. The Cavs had a sweet spot coming in the summer of 2014, when James was a free agent, where their young players hadn't yet graduated to big-money contracts, so there would be salary cap space available to sign James. He also rehired Mike Brown, who coached James between 2005 and 2010 before being fired as coach. Grant believed Brown's past success would help the team into the playoffs. Despite reports James hadn't approved of Brown in the past, Grant had vetted the idea and felt confident Brown would be an asset in a possible James chase. Then there was the Ogauskas jersey retirement, perhaps the most intriguing maneuver of them all. Since Ogauskas was an employee of the team, a Cleveland resident, and a lock to have his jersey retired, the Cavs could have done the ceremony at any time. They could have done it the next game, or they could have waited a year. There's no standard for such matters. But Grant wanted to use James's closeness to Ogauskas to the franchise's advantage. He wanted to open a window to bring James to Cleveland alone, without the Heat, for the event. So in the fall of 2013, the Cavs and Heat's schedules were placed side by side and studied. A date was found in March that was amenable to Ogauskas as well. The Cavs were playing at home on a Saturday night against the Knicks. It was later in the season, where the team would, in theory, be making a run toward the playoffs. The Heat had an off night in nearby Chicago. They were coming to Cleveland for a game 10 days later when James would have been there, and Ogauskas' jersey could have been retired then. But Grant didn't want that. They wanted him to come as a guest, not as an opponent. And they had cover to anyone who might ask that this was a weekend when it would be easier to bring friends and family in, and it wouldn't have the baggage that Heat-Cavs games carried. Would James be willing to come to town for it? The concept was presented to his representation. James did not commit, but it was made clear he would come if things worked out. It was a silent victory. In October 2013, the Cavs announced the date with the hope James would be there. And as they made their plans, which got grander and grander, they did so with him in mind. But then there were some hiccups, primarily in the team's play. The free agents the team signed, veterans Jarrett Jack, Andrew Bynum, and Earl Clark, failed to make the expected impact. Bynum, a high-risk, high-reward signing, was particularly an issue as he clashed with the coaching staff. He was traded at midseason for veteran Luol Deng. The team also didn't respond to Brown, known for his defensive coaching skills, and lagged in the standings, starting the season 10-21. In February 2014, the Cavs lost an embarrassing home game to an injury-riddled Los Angeles Lakers team that finished the game with only 4 eligible players. The Cavs gave up 119 points and lost by 11. The team was roundly mocked for the result, which was a 6th straight loss to drop them 17 games under 500. The plan to impress James had gone awry. Frustrated, Gilbert fired Grant the day after the Laker loss, as the unofficial Get LeBron Back plans officially went off the track. A month later, however, James announced he was chartering a private jet at his expense to fly from Chicago to Cleveland to see Ogauskas' jersey retired. The Heat publicly endorsed the decision, but privately weren't pleased, and not just because they had a game the next afternoon against the Bulls on national television. They sent team personnel and security with James, but he was courtside to watch the spectacle, smiling and embracing Ogauskas as he left the floor. Fans screamed to him, not at him. There wasn't a boo to be heard. The Cavs, of course, lost by 10 points to the Knicks that night, in a new losing streak that was 4 games long, as their playoff hopes were essentially crushed. The organization wondered if all the planning they poured into it had even been worth it. The next day in Chicago, James played poorly, missing 15 of 23 shots as the Heat lost. But he was still smiling from the moment with Ilgauskas. "It was a special, special time for Z," he said that day, "and I'm so happy I was able to be a part of it." James had once fed on the hatred he felt in Quicken Loans Arena. When he first made his return there, in December 2010, he scored 38 points and led a 28-point drubbing, despite a flood of negative energy. Fans used social media to coordinate mocking chants. His old jerseys that hadn't been destroyed were used in various ways to attack him, with new and inventive names replacing his on the back. Cavs fans were burned by his departure. In the rush to try to understand James's choice, theories rushed in to fill the information void. They ranged from salacious to bizarre. Some fans were convinced that James had constructed an elaborate, protracted plan that included the previous season's playoffs when he suffered an ill-timed slump in a series loss to the Celtics. James has said many times these claims were untrue. Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, the free agents who joined him in Miami, said they didn't get serious about plans to all go to Miami until after all of their previous seasons had ended. Not everyone believed them. James was suffering from a sore elbow, and that somewhat limited him in the Celtics series. But Cleveland's relationship with the favored son had become radioactive. Nuance and sworn statements did not matter. With all that baggage in the recent past, here still was James coming back for a ceremony. No one, not even James himself, fully knew what any of it would ultimately mean. And no one could have guessed that the next time the Knicks visited Cleveland for a game, James would be there for that one too, in a Cavs uniform. Chapter 2, Target Acquisition Mode. The Cavs ended the 2013-14 season losing four of their last six games to settle at 33-49, missing the playoffs by five games. It was the end of a disastrous 6 months. The number one overall pick from the previous year, Anthony Bennett, had a terrible rookie season, and his conditioning and work ethic were as much in question as his talents. Their free agent signings from the previous summer had all flopped to varying degrees. In desperation to make the playoffs, they made two mid-season trades, one for forward Lou Alden and the other for center Spencer Hawes, and gave up five draft picks to do so. Both players were free agents at season's end and were showing little interest in re-signing, meaning they'd turned into failed rentals. Their first-round pick from 2 years prior, Dion Waiters, had played alongside franchise player Kyrie Irving for 2 years, and their chemistry was so poor at times that they'd regularly had to deny there was a personal rift between them. Meanwhile, Irving had failed to establish a relationship with new coach Mike Brown, in part over Brown's desire for defense and Irving's lack of consistent interest on that end. That was a problem for two reasons. One was Irving was about to be asked to sign a contract extension, and the organization, attempting to encourage stability, had signed Brown to a 5-year, $20 million contract. The franchise was spinning its wheels and had a leadership void. David Griffin had become the team's acting general manager 2 months before the end of the season, following the firing of predecessor Chris Grant. Unsure of whether he'd even keep the job, Griffin held a bold press conference the week after the season ended in May 2014. With limited power and unsure of his future at the time, Griffin announced the team was moving from asset accumulation mode into target acquisition mode. This was welcome news to many in the fan base who'd grown tired of Grant's slow rebuild the previous 4 years, which involved trading for six additional first-round picks, 10 extra second-round picks, and a build-through-youth approach. Grant's covert campaign to lure James had become a forgotten measure, while the team managed its various problems. The concept of the Cavs aggressively attempting to add talent to make a rapid improvement using their stash of draft picks, young players, and salary cap space was a needed change, of course, but it remained unclear just how Griffin and the Cavs would realistically be able to go about it. In a first step, Cavs ownership came to Griffin and offered him the formal general manager title. In a surprising move, he turned the job down and instead asked for some concessions. He turned down general manager jobs in the past. In 2010, he got into deep talks with the Denver Nuggets about their GM job, and was even consulting on roster moves, starting the first stages of a Carmelo Anthony trade before talks collapsed and he walked away. Griffin had a bit of a different outlook than a typical NBA executive. He was not a former player, coach, or son of someone in the NBA, the three most popular routes to get into a front office. He was raised by a single mother in a rough neighborhood in West Phoenix. He worked his way through high school so his family could afford the tuition at Brophy Prep, an all-boys Jesuit school, then ground his way through Arizona State, eventually earning a degree in political science. His first job in the league was as an intern for the Suns, when he was just 20. He did odd jobs on the side, like keeping statistics for the local Arena Football League team. Slowly, he worked his way up the ranks and became a member of the front office. His life changed forever in 2006 when he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. He went through a grueling chemotherapy. As he and his wife Meredith celebrated the end of his successful treatment as they walked on a beach near Kona, Hawaii, he made a promise that many people who face life-threatening situations do. He wasn't going to sweat the small stuff, which is a difficult proposition when working in the high-pressure world of pro sports. In 2011, a few months after Griffin came to Cleveland to join the Cavs front office, a doctor informed him his cancer had returned. The moment the doctor told him, to Griffin it had felt like the physician said it in passing, almost like a waiter telling him the soup of the day, stuck with him for years. He won that battle too. Now he has a habit of knocking his fist against his head whenever he mentions any good fortune that comes his way. His method of knocking on wood. He's a man keenly aware of enjoying what he has, but who also knows how fragile it all is. It hasn't exactly left him with an endless desire to climb the NBA's executive ladder. That's why he hesitated when he was offered the Cavs' top job, when the team's owners offered to remove his interim label. After days of talks, though, Griffin and owners Dan Gilbert and Nate Forbes did find common ground, and Griffin agreed to take the job. Shortly after he got the interim job the previous February, Griffin's grandmother passed away. He wasn't able to get to Phoenix to see her because he had to stay in Cleveland to execute the trade deadline. The last time he talked to her was over Skype, to tell her he'd made his first trade for Hawes. He was gutted when he didn't make it back to say goodbye. The family waited for the funeral until he could get away from trying to handle the mess the Cavs season had turned into. Griffin was a survivor in every sense. All of that made it a little unfair that there was an absence of joy when Griffin accepted the job. Reaching a mountaintop in one's profession is a moment where there's usually at least a few celebratory days with friends and family. Griffin practically had to introduce himself, as owner Gilbert did not attend the press conference to announce the decision, which was unusual. The honeymoon period was nil, as Griffin's hiring came at the same time Brown was fired, announced in the same press release. The Cavs would be looking for their third coach in three seasons, projecting an aimless organization. More challenging, as he started the coaching search, Gilbert was looking to hire him a boss. The Cavs' two previous coaches, Byron Scott and Brown, had been hired and fired several times. Gilbert wanted a new face, and he wanted someone with a successful resume. This naturally left him looking to the college ranks, especially in the wake of the early success of Brad Stevens, who'd left a successful program at Butler University and been winning positive reviews after his first season with the Boston Celtics. When he had a coaching opening in 2010, Gilbert chased several high-profile college coaches and made a $7 million per year offer to Tom Izzo, the Michigan State legend, whom Gilbert had come to know and admire as an MSU graduate. Izzo, though, was unable to get assurance about the future from James, then a free agent. After seriously considering Gilbert's offer and making a high-profile visit to Cleveland, Izzo passed. Now, 5 years later, there'd been a shift in the coaching landscape. Doc Rivers had become the president and coach of the Los Angeles Clippers. Flip Saunders had taken on a similar role in Minnesota. Greg Popovich had such a job in San Antonio. 2 days after the Cavs fired Brown, Stan Van Gundy was given the coveted dual roles in Detroit. As Gilbert sought another college coach, the stakes had been raised. Highly respected coaches and those secure in what were essentially lifetime jobs wouldn't just be looking for a huge paycheck, but supreme power over the front office, too. And with power, they wanted assurances in the form of long contracts. Gilbert had parted ways with three GMs in 9 years as owner and was paying two coaches he'd recently fired. But there was also a sudden shift in the Cavs landscape. A week after Griffin was hired, he went to New York for the NBA's annual draft lottery. The Cavs had the ninth best chance of winning, an uninspiring 1.7%. While in the rebuilding phases between 2011 and 2013, Gilbert made the lottery a major event. He brought his son Nick to be the team's onstage representative and rejoiced when winning in 2011 and 2013. He brought a group of supporters in on his private plane in 2013, many of them wearing bow ties, as was Nick Gilbert's tradition. When they won that year, with a 15.6% chance, the group exploded in celebration at the normally staid event and was criticized for it. That pick was Bennett, and his flop had significantly contributed to the Cavs being compelled to return to the NBA's convention of non-playoff teams again. Because of those circumstances, the Cavs contingent arrived at the ABC studios on May 20th, 2014, like a lamb. There was no traveling party and no Nick or Dan Gilbert, who was not in the studio. As when Griffin was hired, he was thrust out to be on his own. As it came down to the final envelope, he rubbed the pin on his lapel, an angel with a tiny diamond that had been one of his grandmother's few valuable possessions. When the Cavs won the top pick, the only clapping came from him. The lottery was televised before Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Finals between the Miami Heat and Indiana Pacers. There were two televisions in the visitors' locker room in Indianapolis that night. One showed film of the Heat's Game 1 loss 2 nights earlier. The other was on the lottery. As Griffin celebrated and tapped the pin over his heart, James watched as he was being stretched for the game. The Cavs were already thinking big when it came to their coach. Gilbert was further emboldened to chase a famous name now that the job came with a chance to draft Andrew Wiggins or Jabari Parker, the two options at number one. Gilbert's first target was University of Kentucky coach John Calipari. But Calipari had some huge contract demands, starting with a 10-year deal. It was later reported that the stakes reached as high as $80 million, but Calipari had just agreed to a new 7-year, $53 million deal with Kentucky and had a loaded team coming for the following season, a team that eventually would take an undefeated record into the Final Four and see four of its players drafted in the top 14 picks of the 2015 NBA draft. The Cavs prospects were unclear, and James at that point wasn't a legitimate part of them. Calipari passed. The big game hunting did not stop. Griffin called Mike Krzyzewski, Duke's legendary coach. He'd turned down much better NBA offers in the past than this one. Again, the Cavs had no James to offer. They'd continued to have dialogue with Paul, James's agent. Paul gave zero assurances other than to indicate Cleveland would be an option if James chose free agency. That was no small thing, but it was far from concrete, and the Cavs couldn't sell it. Griffin flew to Lawrence, Kansas to do on-the-ground research with Bill Self, the Jayhawks' respected coach, who had two high draft pick choices, Wiggins and Joel Embiid. At a meeting with Self, Griffin offered him the coaching job out of the blue. Self was surprised, which was Griffin's intention, and offered to think about it. He did some research on the job over the next few days, but, like Calipari, also passed. Next was Florida coach Billy Donovan, who'd won two national titles and sent numerous high-profile players to the NBA. Donovan indicated he might be ready for the NBA, and soon he and the Cavs were talking. He eventually flew to Cleveland to formally interview. But as talks progressed, Donovan's contract demands caused the Cavs to hesitate, and the sides eventually moved on before the negotiations reached a serious stage. Griffin attempted to recruit Steve Kerr, who had been his former boss in Phoenix and was ready to go into coaching. By the time Griffin got to him, however, Kerr had already been offered the New York Knicks and Golden State Warriors coaching jobs and was soon to choose the Warriors. Griffin talked to Kevin Olley, who just won a championship with the University of Connecticut and was popular among NBA players. But Olley signed an extension to stay. As the process unfolded, Griffin ended up focusing on two other candidates with NBA experience, both of whom worked for the LA Clippers. Alvin Gentry had known Griffin for years and was once head coach of the Suns while Griffin was there too. Tyronn Lue, a retired journeyman point guard, had become known for his ability to connect to players and had studied for several years under Rivers in Boston and Los Angeles. Gentry's resume, filled with a few failed head coaching jobs at previous spots, was similar to Scott's and Brown's, and that didn't impress Gilbert. Neither did Gentry's close relationship with Griffin. Brown was very close to Grant, and that mix hadn't created success for the recently fired pairing. Gilbert wanted to avoid a repeat. Lou was intriguing, especially to Griffin, but light on experience, especially when entered into a field with names like Calipari, Self, and Donovan. As the process played out, another development happened in the league. Kevin Love, the Minnesota Timberwolves All-Star, had been put on the trade market. In the wake of Saunders being hired to run the team, Love was approached about signing an extension, as he was heading into the final year of his contract. He declined, saying he planned to become a free agent in 2015. After years of Love's teetering on this delicate matter, the Wolves had finally decided to move on from him. They were looking for a high draft pick as the centerpiece of a trade. After he'd taken the job, Griffin had lunch with Saunders and they had some discussions about doing a deal for Love. Saunders said he'd be interested if the Cavs ended up with a top three pick to offer. When the Cavs won the draft lottery, Griffin called Love's agent, Jeff Schwartz, who was one of the league's top power brokers. Griffin asked if Love would be interested in staying in Cleveland long-term, a prerequisite to trading a valuable asset for a player with just 1 year on his contract. Schwartz was frank with Griffin. No, Love was not interested in Cleveland. Griffin dropped the matter and returned to the coaching search. Love and Schwartz didn't foresee James as part of the picture and, just like during the talks in the coaching search, neither did Griffin. As for Gilbert, his thoughts on the short-term outlook of his team revealed themselves in another subtle way. As the Cavs were going through a disappointing winter and spring, Gilbert was active in helping Cleveland put together a bid to host the 2016 Republican National Convention. As controller of Quicken Loans Arena, Gilbert was an integral part of the process. The RNC was looking to host their convention as early as June, not August as in previous years, to more quickly access general election funding. That meant the host venue would have to be available from mid to late May, during the heart of the NBA playoffs. The other finalist for the convention was Dallas, but Mavericks owner Mark Cuban told the Dallas Morning News a June convention would be impossible because it would conflict with possible playoff games, and he'd be unwilling to make his arena, the American Airlines Center, available in May. Gilbert, his team out of the playoffs for four consecutive years, was willing to promise his arena could be made free as early as May 2016. Cleveland, for various reasons, including arena availability, won the bid before James made his free agency decision. With the coaching search extending, the team was pitched a different kind of candidate, one who was an out-of-the-box option like Gilbert was searching for. David Blatt, the American coach of EuroLeague power Maccabi Tel Aviv, quietly hired an American agent and began looking for a chance in the NBA. He interviewed for several jobs over the phone while his season in Europe was still going on. He eventually had a Skype interview with Gilbert that went well. In mid-June, he announced he was resigning to pursue opportunities in the NBA. Blatt, who had coached in Italy, Russia, Turkey, and Greece, as well as Israel, had been on the radar for several years, especially after a Tor Messina, regarded as one of Europe's finest coaches, joined the Lakers as an assistant coach in 2011. Blatt had just finished a most impressive season, leading underdog Maccabi to several unlikely victories in winning the EuroLeague title. His stock was also high after coaching the Russian national team to a bronze medal at the 2012 Olympics, a surprising result. While Russia's coach for the 2010 World Championships in Istanbul, he'd gotten into a war of words with Krzyzewski, the Team USA coach, over the 1972 Olympic gold medal game, which the Russians won controversially over the United States. Despite his American citizenship, Blatt backed his employer and said the Russians had won fairly. Krzyzewski was not amused. Nonetheless, it displayed the type of guile Blatt had become famous for coaching in Europe, even if only far-flung NBA scouts got to see it. During the 2012 Olympics in London, he ejected two of his best players from the bench because they'd talked to each other while he was trying to go over a play in a huddle. There were many of these stories in his past, but this one played out on American television. Within days of his resignation, Blatt came to the United States after his father passed away. Shortly after the funeral, he met with Kerr, who was filling out his coaching staff with the Warriors. Kerr, who spent much of his childhood in the Middle East, shared an agent and a sensibility with Blatt, who'd been in Israel for most of his adult life after graduating from Princeton. Kerr was prepared to make Blatt his lead assistant, and Blatt verbally accepted the job. Then the Cavs, running out of options, called asking for Blatt to come for a 2-day interview in Cleveland. Gilbert had just met with Lou, who'd become a finalist, and then met Blatt. Gilbert was intrigued by Blatt because, like the college coaches he'd gone after previously, Blatt had a record of championships. He coached under adverse conditions everywhere from St. Petersburg, Russia, to Treviso, Italy, to Thessaloniki, Greece. He'd won coaching defense-based teams, he'd won using the Princeton offense, he'd won using fast-breaking schemes, and he'd shown guts along the way. Shortly after the meeting ended, Gilbert got in the car for a ride from Cleveland back to Detroit, where he lived, and immediately started making calls, doing a personal vetting. He called coaches he knew, he investigated what the media's reaction might be to hiring essentially a foreign coach. The Cavs would later reach out to people at USA Basketball to get their impression. Blatt, unsure how he had done, made plans to fly to San Francisco the next day and get ready to start work with Golden State. "We talked to 30 people in Europe. There wasn't a person who wouldn't rave about this guy," Gilbert said. "We talked to 4 or 5 American players who played for him over there. Rarely do you call a player and ask about an ex-coach and he is complimentary, but they were." Despite the recommendations, there wasn't universal agreement on Blatt. It was a risk because he'd never coached in the NBA and had lived abroad for 30 years. But he'd performed well in the interview with his mix of confidence and experience. Some in the organization suggested that the adjustment from coaching in Europe to the NBA might be easier than the adjustment from coaching in college to the league might be. This had never been tried before. What if the team had unearthed a formula? He was American, but he was also exotic by NBA standards. He'd be a bit of a unicorn. Gilbert liked the idea that he might have been able to discover the next great NBA coach. And Blatt was Jewish, a factor that helped connect him to Gilbert as well. Griffin, an NBA lifer who'd spent plenty of time scouting in Europe over the years, wasn't as sure. With Gentry out of the picture, he'd eventually take the top assistant job with the Warriors that Blatt ended up passing on. Griffin was interested in Lou. Lou had a vast network of allies and bonds with players and teams around the league. Everyone who played with him didn't just seem to like him, they seemed to admire him. Griffin thought this was perhaps rarer still than Blatt's resume. Gilbert, though, had reached his choice with Blatt. As they talked about the direction, ownership and Griffin discussed a compromise. Attempt to hire Lou as well. Try to get Lou to be the top assistant, getting both their choices. The experienced veteran would bring in fresh European sensibilities to lead, and he'd have an ultimate insider and former player as a lieutenant. On its face, the concept was awkward. The runner-up would act as the winner's forced right-hand man. Many experienced NBA coaches, which Blatt was not, would have rejected such an idea. Griffin also wanted to keep another assistant, veteran Jim Boylan, meaning Blatt wouldn't have hiring power for much of his key staff. But the compromises cascaded down the line. In hiring Blatt, Griffin would retain personnel power and still be the head of basketball operations, which wasn't a possibility with some candidates. Blatt was getting what he'd dreamed of, a head NBA job. And it would come with a 3-year contract that guaranteed him more than $10 million and had an option and bonuses that could kick in millions more. That made it easier for him to accept Lou, who was lured away from the Clippers when Gilbert greenlighted the largest contract ever given to an assistant coach, 4 years and $6.5 million. After it all came together, Gilbert raved about his new unicorn. "David Blatt is going to bring some of the most innovative approaches found in professional basketball anywhere on the globe. Time and time again, from Russia to Israel and several other prominent head coaching jobs in between, David has done one thing, win. He is not only an innovator, well-trained and focused on both sides of the court, but he is always learning and always teaching. Blatt was excited and loose in his big moment as he was introduced as coach. Though he was coming onto the biggest stage of his career, he joked that he was more than ready for the scrutiny of being a head coach.